do more. I think that's good, and so we can work.
Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seat. I will note we do have a quorum present. The first item of business is the approval of the minutes from March 8th. Is there a motion for approval? Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that these minutes are approved as presented.
Representative Baker moves that we approve the minutes as presented to March 8th, 2023. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, we've got five bills on the agenda today, and pending outside circumstances, this may be our final meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee for the 2023 regular session. All five of the bills we have met deadline in the Senate today, so we are able to hear them in our committee. Our first bill will be House File 1596 from Representative Breyer. Unfortunately, Representative Breyer is not able to join us, so we have Representative Edelson, who has been kind enough to take over presenting the bill. Representative Edelson, would you move and introduce House File 1596, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1596 is moved to the Human Finance Committee.
Okay, thank you, Representative Edelson, for moving House File 1596 to be referred to Human Services Finance Committee, and thank you for jumping in to explain the bill on behalf of Representative Breyer. If you'd like to go ahead, please.
You bet, Mr. Chair. So House File 1596, PACE Programs for All-Inclusive Care for Elderly Bill, is a program that is innovative program that allows people of all ages starting at age 55, most of whom are dually eligible for Medicaid and Medicare, to receive comprehensive medical and social services while they still are in the community. Although all PACE participants are eligible for nursing home care, 95% continue to live at home. PACE programs coordinate and provide all needed preventative, primary, acute, and long-term care services so older individuals can continue to live in the community. Through PACE, healthcare systems come together to serve the unique needs of each individual in a way that makes sense to elderly individuals with complex needs, their informal caregivers, healthcare providers, and policymakers. Research has shown that PACE saves tax dollars through a lower cost model and of care that has been proven to be effective preventing hospitalizations, and it helps to support and improve family caregiving. As we continue to look at ways to smooth transitions to and from hospitals to alleviate discharge delays and address social determinants for patients, PACE has had an opportunity to be one of the upstream solutions. In particular, PACE has also proven to support underserved communities with high quality, flexible care in the person's home. Minnesota has had enabling language in the statute for some time now. This bill would direct DHS to conduct a required actuarial rate study and propose a implementation plan, which is a critical step towards the program implementation. In your package, you should have a letter of support from organizations, or several, including the Alzheimer's Association, Leadership Council on Aging, and the provider organizations. I would now like to turn it over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Our first testifier we have is Mr. Wayne Olson. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Wayne Olson. I work with Presbyterian Homes and Services of Minnesota. As has often been shared, the number of seniors in Minnesota will increase significantly in the next 8 to 10 years. This will put a strain on our legacy senior care capacity from home and community-based services to place-based care, with an increasing challenged workforce to be serving those individuals. The program for all-inclusive care for the elderly is a proven, innovative option which is available to aid in choices for seniors 55 and older in Minnesota to assist in addressing this expanding need. PACE successfully serves individuals facing increased medical and emotional challenges of achieving their own positive aging. PACE provides personalized care designated to maintain their maximum independence in the place that they want to call home. Our seniors in the past have relied on family, churches, and fraternal organizations for help and support as they age. All these supports are not as robust as they were in the past. As informal support is less available, the medical and emotional issues faced by our seniors are becoming more significant and complex. Increasing the challenge of receiving and providing these support services is made all the more challenging with the increased diversity of language and cultures of our seniors in Minnesota. PACE wraps personalized services around the senior for their well-being in partnership with families if available. This support assists in preventing burnout and providing relief to caregivers. Caregivers who are most often women, often trying to balance family, work responsibility, and the core commitments made to their senior loved one to help them maintain their independence in later years as they desperately want to honor. PACE services are expansive, mostly located in a central building, a day center, if you will, that includes a full medical clinic, bathing facilities, nutritional services, social integration, physical therapies, social work, home health care services, and a full transportation system. In other models, these services are most often third-party relationships. In PACE, these solutions are organized and coordinated as sponsor-controlled solutions, often with services supplemented by partnering with existing community services. Typically, the senior visits the central center about 2 to 3 times per week. Due to the focus on individualized care that is provided, that the provided care is when needed and where needed, the efficiency in this model is significant. Generally, PACE programs use 50% of the FTEs to provide similar care that is provided in nursing homes. In an era of staff shortages, labor shortages, we see this as a promising solution and contributing factor to finding a way in the future to serve the ever-increasing number of seniors. The funding for this program is a combination of Medicare and Medicaid. The state study we are requesting funding for identifies service costs that would be expected to be paid by the state by county for the population that PACE would serve. The Medicaid portion of the PACE rate cannot, by CMS regulations, be more than what would be expected to be expended by the state, and actually less. The rate is all-inclusive, covering all costs for medical needs and related social determinants of care. The key to success in a PACE is the alignment of incentives. The elders who want to remain living in the community, the state that wants to save money in escalating labor cost environment, and a sponsor who wants to focus on wellness and preventative care to avoid expensive avoidable hospitalizations and preventable long-term care placements. As there is often needs for hospital stays and various procedures and some nursing home stays, when those occur, the sponsor has full financial obligation for those. In my career, I was responsible to start and operate PACE programs in other states, doing so with a positive experience and providing care in the place that they call home. I saw many examples of seniors that had significant chronic issues as well as serious memory loss issues being able to remain at home and being meaningful contributors as elders in the family that they love. One example I'd like to share is the victim of a drive-by shooting, an 85-year-old lady who lost the lower part of her leg and other related injuries. Thanks to PACE and a very supportive team that she was surrounded with, her care and recovery was accelerated, receiving many of the services that she needed to receive in the PACE environment. Eventually, she was able to walk with the prosthesis. She was able to remain at home with her family and with her social support network. I can't say the same outcome would have occurred in the absence of PACE and would have, in certainty, resulted in a nursing home placement and health complications that would have had much longer hospitalization. As we continue to wrestle with bottlenecks in our hospitals and healthcare system that needs to reflect the aging of our state, PACE is a tested solution that Minnesota needs to pursue. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for your testimony. And if you want to stay close by in case there's any questions.
Sure.
Next I have Dr. Joe Gogler, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair. My name is Joe Gogler. I am a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. I hold what's called the Robert L. Kane Endowed Chair in Long-Term Care and Aging, and I also direct our Center for Healthy Aging and Innovation. And I'm really thrilled to be here. really thrilled to lend my own, as well as the Center for Healthy Aging and Innovation, support to this bill. One of the things I really enjoy when I go around the country and go to different conferences or give different presentations is hearing how much people respect the innovation of Minnesota when it comes to community-based long-term services and supports. The state has been seen as a model, if not a laboratory of sorts, for many other states. But the one thing I've never understood in all of my time here is why we don't have PACE. PACE is seen as the gold standard of community-based services and supports in the U.S., in part because, and this is what we know when it comes to providing good quality care to older people with complex co-occurring conditions, is the need for integrated services and supports, integrating acute care with chronic care. PACE does that brilliantly and perhaps better than any other model that I can think of. There certainly have been successors to this model, but nonetheless, PACE remains the gold standard. One of the things I do as part of my position is I'm hoping to visit every county in Minnesota to really provide dementia care education and then also engage community members in conversation. It's going to take me a while. There's 87 counties. I've only hit around 20 so far. But the need for this is consistent. And I have a feeling I've probably been in some of your regions of the state at this point, too. The need for sufficient services so people can live where they want, which is home. So that is why the Center for Healthy Aging and Innovation heartily support this bill. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome, and thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House File 1596? Not seeing any members. Are any questions or comments that you have? Not seeing, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for picking up the pace. I think this is something that we need to really look into, and I'm assuming this is bill is just creating the study and not implementing the program as is right now.
Representative Edelson.
Maybe to one of the testifiers.
Yes, yeah. One of the testifiers.
Yeah, that would,
Mr. Olson?
Sure. Yeah, in order to move forward, there's two things that need to take place in order for this to become operational. First is the enabling legislation, as was mentioned, is in place. The next is the actuarial study in order to determine the financial viability, if you will, and the rate structure for that. We would assume through this that there would then be work that would be done through DHS to prepare and to bring this bill to life, assuming that all the other pieces were in place.
Chair North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the professor stated that they, I just wanted to know why, if you have looked into why, what have we not implemented PACE in the state of Minnesota?
Dr. Gogler, if you'd like to come forward, please.
Time to get political, I guess.
Representative Noor, I mean, that's an excellent question. I think it's come down to some questions related to the funding model. The reimbursement rates, for example, that would be provided as part of the program, are they sufficient for the state of Minnesota? You know, sometimes questions are raised, and I hear this a lot when we talk of innovation, where some entities will say, well, we already do that. We do this program. We do X program. But the reality is we don't do it. The thing about PACE is, and when you talk to people, I think when you go out to communities, the thing that really differentiates PACE is when you're in PACE, you know you're in PACE. Mr. Olson mentioned that it's often delivered underneath an umbrella of an adult day service program. The easiest way to think of PACE, it's an adult day service program with steroids. The program itself has all of these integrated components that are flexible and able to run efficiently. And a good example, I think, of PACE's efficiencies and effectiveness was what we see what happened to PACE during the COVID-19 pandemic. Many community-based programs were shut down. PACE, however, was able to maintain its enrollment and service because of its flexibility. It could pivot to home health visits, for example. So, again, it's a program that intuitively we should have it. You all know better than I the political process. We don't. I hope you can address that today. So,
thank you very much. Chair Orr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Not seeing any other questions or comments. Representative Edelson, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I would like to renew my motion to move House File 1596 to be re-referred to Human Service Finance.
Very good. All those in favor of referring House File 1596 to the Human Services Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. House File 1596 is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for filling in for Representative Ryer. Appreciate it. Now we will get on to one of your bills.
Thank you.
And before I do that, I just want to say I do notice that we've got a few people that are here today from some of the groups out there. I want to say thank you for when you came in. Thank you for leaving your signs out there, and welcome to the committee. We appreciate you all being here today. Thank you. Next, I will pop on to Representative Edelson. We will be going on to your House File 1298. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 1298 to be referred to Human Service Finance.
Very good, and I understand you have an author's A1 amendment. Would you like to explain that and move your A1 amendment?
The A1 gets the bill in the shape I'd like it to be in, so if we could just, the committee wouldn't mind just accepting it, and I'll explain the bill.
Very good. Any questions on the author's A1 amendment? Not seeing any. All in favor of the author's A1 amendment to House File 1298, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, and House File 1298 is now amended with the A1 author's amendment. Representative Edelson, if you'd like to explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In 2020, 99 Minnesotans were living with Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. The number is expected to increase to 21.2% by 2025. This comes at great personal cost to Minnesota families. The state feels these impacts as well. Minnesota spends $905 million a year, or it spent in 2020. In Medicaid, these costs are projected to increase to 20.1% in 2025. The challenges that are faced are many, and I'm going to keep this relatively short and just explain the bill and let my testifiers talk a little bit more about in terms of the context. Section 1 of this bill increases the maximum funding for an essential community support recipient can receive from $400 per month to $600 per month. It expands the eligible services that the ECS benefit can pay for, including respite care and companion services. For context, essential community supports are limited benefits for seniors with elevated medical needs that do not qualify for MA. There are only a small number of Minnesotans who are on essential community supports, but there is a great need for this type of support. Our hope is that increasing the supports from $400 to $600 per month and moving this legislation will raise the profile of the program. And Section 2 appropriates base funding for respite care grants program for older adults and people with dementia, previously funded through one-time ARPA ARPA funding. Our long-term care system is in crisis, and we cannot afford to lose unpaid caregivers and put even more pressure on an overwhelmed elder care system. This bill invests in respite care grants, which are short-term supports, so that a primary caregiver can recharge their batteries and complete a chore like laundry or buying groceries. This bill provides ongoing base funding for competitive grants to sustain existing respite care providers and expand access to underserved communities. With that, Mr. Chair, I will move to my testifier.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Edelson. I have on the list here Mr. Sam Smith. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the Alzheimer's Association to testify in support of House File 1298 and the loved ones who provide care for someone living with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is a public crisis that demands urgent action from policymakers. The challenges facing the long-term care workforce are well documented, and we support efforts this committee and the legislature are taking to address this crisis. However, not enough attention is being paid to the unpaid caregivers and the foundational role they play in keeping loved ones at home, where they want to be, and out of more expensive and intensive settings like an assisted living or nursing home. In 2022, 163,000 Minnesota caregivers provided 225 million hours of unpaid care valued at $5.259 billion. This comes at a cost. The stress and emotional toll of caring for a loved one with dementia leads to higher rates of chronic conditions like depression or hypertension, and caregivers are burning out at increasing rates. Caregiver burnout is the leading cause for placement in a more inexpensive residential setting. To be brief, I'll go ahead to a study that the Department of Human Services commissioned in 2021 on the trajectory of the elderly waiver in Minnesota. A key finding is that, and I quote, there is a progressive need for EW services that builds over years before individuals join the elderly waiver. This creates multiple contacts with the DHS system prior to eligibility and an opportunity to provide lower levels of support and guidance that may delay or prevent spend down to MA or more costly support through MAEW. Areas for opportunity in earlier supports include expanding existing programs such as essential community supports and alternative care, and expanding existing MA programs to provide earlier home and community-based supports prior to EW eligibility, end quote. Expanding access to respite care will allow more people with dementia to be where they want to be, at home with the people they love in the community they know. Thank you for your time, and before we conclude, I would urge you to read the written testimony from Tuesday Glover. She is the Director of Culturally Responsive Caregiver Support and Dementia Services at VOAMN, and describes the significant need for respite care services in the African American and East African communities here in the metro. Thank you for your time, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And in the packets we had today, the letter from Tuesday Glover is included, so please make sure that we review that. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House File 1298? Not seeing any members. Are there any questions or comments for the author or her testifiers? Not seeing any. Representative Enelson, closing comments and renewal. Would you like to make closing comments and renew your motion?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our family has, my father-in-law had Alzheimer's for years, and we really watched the toll that it took on my mother-in-law. It happens with caregivers all throughout the state. Respite care is such an important tool that we can use to keep people out of more confined settings. And so I thank you for your support today. And then I guess would move that House File 1298 be re-referred to Human Service Finance again.
All those in favor of referring House File 1298 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion is approved, and House File 1298, as amended, is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Once again, our next bill is another bill from Representative Edelson, House File 2552. Representative Edelson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes. I believe House File 2552 is going to be laid over.
The Human Services Finance.
Oh, it's going to Human. You know, Mr. Chair, I guess I would request that it be laid over, and we just change this up a little bit, because if we could talk about a little bit more about the bill.
We can definitely do that. And when you say laid over, are you saying that because
the bill needs to be worked on.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm asking is if we lay it over, that means that we may not get to it this year and it may come back next year. Is that fine with that? Otherwise, because I do know you have another committee stop, and you can continue to work.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's move it to House File, or let's move House File 2552 to Human Service Finance then.
No, and I appreciate it. I don't want to kill a bill if I or stop a bill at this point if there's still work occurring. And we still have another spot where you can still stop and say if you need more time, you can take it. So thank you. And I do know you have an author's A1 amendment.
And I'm not going to adopt that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So if we could just leave it.
All right, so we're not going to do the A1 amendment. Would you like to go ahead and talk about 2552?
I would. So, members, House File 2552 is a really good intention, but it really needs a lot of work. It's something that came later on in session. As we know, our revisor's office is quite backed up, and so I know that this bill, I think, did get a hearing in the Senate already, so we would be meeting second deadline here. But quite frankly, the bill is not what I think it needs to be. What it aims to do is it's intended to create an oversight and accountability for organizations that offer recovery services and peer support. What I would say is I think what we might want to do is a task force on this. So I'd like to put my legislative intent on the record. I think a task force, after speaking with DHS and others, is probably going to be the best way to really come to look at some oversight and making sure that we're really adequately regulating and supporting peer support specialists. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to talk more about it with committee members or take questions. And I apologize about throwing this little curveball at you.
No, that's okay, Representative Edelson. And what I want to do is, I know you don't have any testifiers, but I just want to see if there's anyone from the public that wanted to talk. And I do see we have somebody from the public that'd like to speak on 2552. Welcome to the committee. Okay. Thank you for being here today. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Amy Delwo. Currently, I work as the Vice President of Strategic Policy and Growth for Kairos. And there's a number of friends in the audience, if you will, who are on our way to a rally in the Rotunda for Substance Use Disorder Awareness and the Pathways to Recovery Bill. Thank you, Representative Frederick. And so today, folks needed or felt the need to stop by because they were concerned about the current disposition of the bill. And there were a couple concerns that they had in terms of there's a lot of stigma that has already surrounded substance use disorders. And with this particular bill, it is calling out substance use disorder in a way that is different from any other medical assistance service in terms of oversight. And so that was one of the concerns that folks had. I think the other question that folks have is there some sort of Department of Human Services report that shares exactly why this oversight is needed? Because there is, of course, at the Department of Human Services, a provider enrollment system. They have a whole division related to that to assure that providers are appropriate to be providing services to medical assistance clients. And in addition to that, they also have a fraud, waste, and abuse division, as well as a survey, surveillance, integrity, and review division. And overarching that is the Office of Inspector General. And so feel like the department has the appropriate tools and experts in place to address some of this oversight, unless there's something different that we're not seeing in the bill. And so felt compelled to just share that in terms of the approach of the bill, that this was something that was concerning, and that we want to have people receiving the services that they justly deserve, and that we want to have quality services delivered, right? And really looking to see where that's not occurring, because we want to be helpful to the effort. But there's a number of folks here who are actually peer providers themselves and feel that they do an excellent job in their work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, and thank you for being here, and thank you for the presentation today. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? Not seeing any, we will go to members' comments and questions. I know that I have Representative Backer. If you'd like to go ahead, Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I know you've done a lot of work. I'm kind of, and I know Representative Baker has carried this bill. I think this is looking good. I mean, what outside of putting together a task force, what are your thoughts? I mean, you've talked to, I'm assuming, other stakeholders and so forth. So I guess not from that facial expression. So, but I know Representative Baker has worked on it, but what's your thoughts on what changes are you looking for, and why don't you want this right now?
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Backer. This bill was just brought to me about a week ago, and so it's not really characteristic of the work I've historically done, where I do get to meet with stakeholders as much as I would like to. But after, you know, really giving the bill a thorough review and speaking with a few folks about it, I really do think that we need peer support specialists, and to all of you who are here, I value your work. I don't want you to think that's not the case. I do. We want to make sure that peer support services are trusted like they are, but there has been some claims of abuse. And so I just want to make sure that we're looking through and vetting this process. I don't want to move a bill through quickly. I want to make sure that I have a little bit more time. So the current draft as it is, I don't think is sufficient. I think it needs more work. And so I guess I don't know, Mr. Becker, if I've answered your question, Representative.
Representative Becker.
And I don't want to, because you've just seen it. Is there a particular provision in the bill that that you're not pleased with, if I could use that word?
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we need more stakeholder engagement on this. And so my hesitation is in creating policy without having real comprehensive discussion around it. I think the task force would provide us that so that we're creating good, lasting, strong policy.
Representative Becker.
And I appreciate the questions. They're not trying to get you as gut shoot questions. I like this bill here, and I'm not a big person of task force, but I do respect getting other stakeholders if you think that's needed. That's all I have right now.
Okay, thank you. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, thanks for bringing this. And again, you and I have had some conversations about this. I think, and again, I sent out some questions about the bill earlier, too, about, hey, I didn't like some things. And I signed on it. I'm a co-author on the bill because I think we've got folks out there that are working their tails off to do really good work in the substance use disorder world. And these peer recovery specialists are the next greatest thing to this crisis that we're facing. And again, like you have stated, I am so grateful for these people that are living this life of experience and having walked that journey, and now they're helping other people. We are wanting to make sure that we find a really good stood up plan so that they can be accredited and be having a system where we pay them better. And there's a lot of things that come along this way too. But we also, I think with Representative Edelson and I, we're very cautious about making sure that we get this right so that this new industry that's coming out, this new position in the substance use community, is being done right. I mentioned my work on ORAC, the Opioid Epidemic Advisory Council, to these members. And we had a review from our friends over at First Results, which is MMB, and their feedback to us that we pay them to do this. They've given us some very good, honest feedback about there's some great things about the peer recovery specialists and what they're doing, but we're still struggling with either keeping them in the industry. We want to make sure that we've got the programs stood up properly. And this bill is part of doing it right. I guess I kind of appreciate you just taking a pause on this for a second. Let's get it moving on. Let's work on it. I guess I'm committed to doing that with you as well, because this is I had a lot of questions about who's going to do the appointments, who should sit on this. I think, again, going through the process that Representative Olson and I did when we did ORAC, we have 19 members, very carefully selected seats, and I want to relook at that process too. So saying all that, while this bill is, I think, good intentions, and I think we also need to hear more from DHS. And we haven't heard enough from DHS yet on this bill. I don't know that today's the day to do it. I'm going to leave that up to Representative Edelson, but there are questions and concerns that I think we should have heard by now, and we haven't, from that agency that we could have. And I want to make sure that's something that we could do, because we do need to get something going. And I think we need to kind of find out what their concerns are, what their thoughts are, and I'm open to having them, you know, come visit with me anytime. But I do support this initiative and how we need to do this. So I do support it moving forward, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Baker. That's helpful to know. Representative Edelson, your thoughts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. You are our trusted advocate here at the Capitol on these issues, and it's always good to partner with you. And I appreciate you hearing out my perspective on doing the task force, because I think what we have learned now, my fifth year being here, is these policies that we create do matter. We need to have comprehensive discussions. We need to make policy that lasts. And people know that. And peer support specialists are so incredibly valuable in that continuum of your journey. I just want to make sure we get it right. And rushing through policy is not a good idea. So I think this task force, I'm going to work on it. It's a good idea to keep it going to finance. I'll make sure that we can get that drafted up. We'll have DHS at the table. We'll have the RCOs at the table. We'll make sure that we're getting a good comprehensive discussion. So next year we can actually pass legislation. People will feel like they're heard versus coming and having a piece of legislation we just had dropped last week. But I appreciate you keeping this on the calendar so we could have this discussion. I really did want to put the legislative intent on the record on what I really believe that we should be doing here moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Middleton, and I very much appreciate the work that you're doing and how conscientious you are, and also with Representative Baker, how the two of you have worked on things in the past. Looking forward to you folks partnering together on it. And as you hear from me, I want to make sure that, you know, there's some good stuff here that needs to happen in this world. I want to make sure that we can provide the space for that to continue going forward here, understanding that if it's not quite right, that, you know, then at a certain point we just say, okay, we're going to hold it off and we'll bring it back next year. I want to make sure we've got it well positioned so that if things are falling together, that we can keep things moving along to help professionalize things and take things to the next level that we need to do it at. Is there anyone else that has any other questions or comments that they'd like to make? Not seeing any. What we'll do then, I will say thank you to Representative Edelson and Representative Baker who are working together on this. Representative Edelson, any closing comments? Would you like to renew your motion?
No closing comments. I think we had a good discussion. I really appreciate members giving me some latitude there and how that worked. I renew my motion then to move House File. Oh goodness, you guys! It's been a day. 2552 to the Human Service Finance Committee. Thank you.
All those in favor of referring House File 2552 to the Human Services Finance Committee, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and House File 2552 is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. We'll give it just a moment for people. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for your comments. As you can see, we are looking to continue work in this area. We'll look forward to your continued input. Thank you. Our next bill that we're going to be hearing today is House File 2709 from Representative Curran. If you'd like to set yourself up to the table there, would you like to move your bill, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move to refer House File 2709 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Curran moved House File 2709 to the Human Services Finance Committee. If you'd like to go ahead and explain your bill.
Yes, I'll be brief and turn it over to the testifier. But this bill, in a nutshell, it will allow for an exception so that we can utilize units in specific facilities to meet the needs of folks who are currently stuck in hospital or nursing type nursing facilities. We've had a lot of conversations in this committee about that issue, and so this would address it in a small way, but would mean a lot to those few people. So I'll turn it over to my testifier to explain further.
Very good. Mr. Josh Berg, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Josh Berg. I am with Accessible Space, Inc., based here in St. Paul. Thank you to Representative Curran for carrying this bill. Thank you to the department, Christy and team, for providing the TA that we met about a couple weeks back. And special thanks to Alex at the revisor's office for the super fast turnaround time and getting this through and all buttoned up. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for finding time during these last couple weeks to cram everything in. I appreciate it. I've spoken on this bill and this issue in the past in this committee briefly, and so won't go into great detail on it unless there are questions. But essentially, this bill will give DHS the cover and permission, basically, to apply the exception to the 25% cap on individuals on CADI or BI and their ability to receive customized living services in the settings that we provide services in. Currently, we have three communities at ASI that provide customized living services to individuals. Average age in these settings is about 58 years old, so we have some that are in their 30s, some all the way up into our oldest turns 80 here in April. And for a variety of different reasons, these three settings do not qualify for the current exception process that is in DHS policy right now. Just the two main reasons why these settings don't qualify is technically settings to qualify had to provide customized living services continuously since May 1st, 2001. These settings, two of them in Minneapolis, have been providing services since 1980, and the other one up in Grand Rapids has been providing services since the early 90s. Back in that time, ASI was the first and only shared PCA provider, or the first contracted PCA provider, pooled PCA provider by DHS, and we were granted permission and allowance by DHS commissioners and assistant commissioners back in the day, Tom Moss, Lauren Coleman, to continue to provide that pooled PCA model during a transition period when a lot of other organizations were making the switch to customized living. We didn't technically switch these sites over until 2006, so we missed that 2001 cutoff. Had we known that an exception would require us to do that, 20-plus years later, we may have made different decisions, but we didn't know it existed. And then the other reason why these settings don't qualify currently is because they are HUD-subsidized buildings, and they require a permanent physical disability in order to live in these homes. And because of this, they are exempt or excluded from meeting the exception criteria. So what this bill will do will allow us to utilize the several open units we currently have in some of these settings. We've had folks waiting in hospitals and TCUs to find permanent, affordable, accessible housing, and we've had to hold off because they're under the age of 55 and we're already over the 25% number. And as much as I'd love to approve and provide services free of charge, we have to really make sure that we can have some financial viability to our program. Just for an example, in our Camden home, which is in Representative Lee's district, we have three open units out of the six. So we've been running with 50% vacancy rate right now for many months, and we're losing tens of thousands of dollars, and we're trying to keep it open. This would allow us to move folks in that are under the age of 55, get them out of the hospital, out of the TCUs, and start providing the services that we have the staff for and we have space for, and we're able to allow them to live in a home that they want to live in, actually, as well. So like I said, this is more of a temporary fix as well. You know, I've had conversations with Representative Chernor, and there are lots of settings that have 10 units or less that are kind of in this gray zone of can't transition to ICS, can't choose not to transition to CRS because of the number of units that we provide. So there's work to be done in future sessions to try to figure out where do we find the right licensing framework for these settings. But this, like I said, would allow us to continue to provide services, keep these buildings open until we find that more permanent licensing solution. Tomorrow we have a site visit from the vendor that DHS has selected to kind of look at some of these HUD-subsidized residential settings that have been exempt from the assisted living space. So these kind of fall into that as well. So we'll be able to kind of show them what services are like, what resident choices. I just get the feel and the smell and the taste and the everything of what goes on in these homes. And like I said, folks have been living in these places for a long time. One resident at 28th Street in Minneapolis has been living there since it opened September 29th, 1980. She is currently on our board of directors at ASI and turns 80 next month. So we're really trying to find solutions to keep these folks in place. Our average residency is almost 15 years in these buildings, so we don't turn over a lot of folks. They stay, they live, this is their home, and this is their community. So this would be a tremendous help to us and to our residents, and then we'll continue to work with the department and anyone else to figure out what the long-term licensing solutions might be.
Very good. Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to testify on House File 2709? Not hearing any, going to member comments or questions. Members. Chair Knorr.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. My quick question is, we are extending the services beyond six participants. What will be the limit, the extent that we can add the additional customized services to that specific unit?
Mr. Berg?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr. So this will be specific to these three ASI locations. So the two in Minneapolis are 6 units, and the one in Grand Rapids is 8 units. So it's, I mean, total of this bill just carves out those three settings, and that's it. It allows for, you know, being able to serve more than 25% in Camden, in our Minneapolis location. I mean, we already serve three folks on Caddy that are under the age of 55. So at this point, we couldn't admit anybody else over under the age of 55 and get reimbursed for it and have them be approved for their waivered services. And part of the challenges with these settings, as I mentioned, they're HUD-subsidized settings. And the only requirements to live there are you have to have a permanent physical disability and meet the financial and income requirements. So I can't put on an age limit and say we can only move in folks that are over the age of 55 because we have to follow all the HUD guidelines and requirements. So if anybody applies, meets those criteria, we have to move them in. And then it's a, oh, but sorry, we can't provide your services. And you could potentially bring in your own. So I don't know if I answered your questions, but it's specific to these three sites. 6, 6, and 8 are the total number of units.
Chair Hart.
That was the question. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe I'm not understanding, but so what you're saying is because of some direct rules and requirements, there's probably space for housing for people that need it, but you can't accept them. So in other words, we have empty rooms, but we could fill them.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, yes, that is correct. We've had open units in our Minneapolis location for months and months and months, and I've been working with relocation workers, Hennepin County case managers, and they have been hesitant to pull the trigger on moving folks in because they know we're not going to get reimbursed for it the way that the law stands. We have a gentleman moving in here in a couple weeks. He doesn't turn 55 till this summer, so we're going to eat the cost until or if this gets passed. And if there's a way to make this go retroactive, it would be a beautiful thing. But we're also knowing that, you know, this gentleman is going to turn 55, I think, in May or June. So at the worst, we're going to potentially have to eat a few weeks' worth of costs. But we're going to give him a home, and we're going to get him out of the TCUs and the hospitals that he's been going back and forth in. And we've had several that, you know, the case managers, the relocation workers are hesitant to do, even though we're like, no, let's do it. We'll push. It'll give us a little bit more leverage to put a little bit more pressure on to get this done. So we have a couple other folks looking over at my team. I know we got a 20-something-year-old that wants to move into Camden as well. So I run the risk of a 30-year delay on reimbursement and don't really want to do that. But, yeah, we've had open units for quite some time.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All
right, very good. Any other comments or questions? Not hearing any. Representative Curran, if you'd like to make comments and read the motion.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Berg, for the testimony today, and thank you, committee, for your interest in this and the discussion. I really appreciate the support. Again, this is something that is pretty narrow in scope today, but is quite meaningful to the folks who need this and need this service now. So with that, Chair, I renew my motion to refer House File 2709 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
All those in favor of referring House File 2709 to the Human Services Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion is approved and House File 2709 is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. We are now to our final bill on the agenda. It's House File 1494 from Vice Chair Frederick. We'll give a moment for Vice Chair Frederick to move down. Ooh. Vice Chair Frederick, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1494 be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay, very good. Vice Chair Frederick moves to refer House File 1494 to the Human Services Finance Committee. And I understand you have a DE amendment. Would you like to move your DE amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the DE amendment. There were several revisions after countless hours of meetings with stakeholders, after 8 revisions to the amendment. I think 8?
Is that what,
yeah. 8 revisions to the amendment. This is where we landed on, and hopefully we will be able to pass as a committee.
Okay. We have the DE2 amendment. Are there any questions? This is to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Not seeing any. Members, all in favor of the DE2 author's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and the House File 1494 is amended with the DE2 author's amendment. Vice Chair Frederick, please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill is a personal one to me. Those that know me know that I've spent 18 years working at St. Peter at our state's maximum security psych hospital. In my time there, I have been assaulted. I've had every bodily fluid thrown at me. I've been witness to having countless coworkers been assaulted, and some more severe than others. Some are still disabled to this day because of the injuries that they have suffered on the job. It has been a challenge at times to work there, a challenge to show up to work. And so when I had the opportunity to work on legislation that can attempt to help improve workplace safety across the human services sector, I jumped at it. I do feel the need to clarify something here, and I want to be very clear in my language use here. In the spectrum of mental health services across the state, the overwhelming majority of people who are receiving services of some type on that spectrum are very peaceful, just trying to live their best life and not a source of violence or harm in any way, shape, or form. That's the overwhelming majority. But it is important to acknowledge that in some workplaces, workers are put in harm's way. It is small, but it is happening. And so that's why I want to be very clear to not try to stigmatize or frame this as everyone who has some sort of mental health challenge in a way that they fit into this category. And so I cannot stress that enough. But it is important in the work that we do in the legislature to say we see everyone, and that also includes people that are working in situations where harm does happen. And so working with stakeholders, I have had murders at my facility where I work on the very unit that I worked on. And that, unfortunately, that has even happened in other facilities as well within the human services space. But that's extreme examples, but it has happened along with sexual assaults and physical assaults. And we need to do everything we can to address safety from every perspective possible. Unfortunately, this conversation also comes at a time where there's also an unprecedented workforce shortage that no sector within human services is untouched by. The workforce shortage is expected to get worse over the next 10 years if we don't take action. Burnout and turnover among those workers is an all-time high. While solutions such as increasing wages, reimbursement rates, student loan forgiveness, sign-on bonuses, all those are really good things, it does not address the specific angle of workplace safety. I want to say that these issues are complex and require us to be conscious about how we describe them, which is why I have tried to be as crystal clear in my testimony right now to not try to stigmatize and put everyone into one bubble, because I do not believe that to be true. And in preparation for this hearing, testifiers and we have talked to be very conscious about the language that we use. However, it is one for me that is very personal, and I know that I can get emotional about this because of my friends and my colleagues that I've seen get harmed in such severe ways. We encourage members to do the same in our discussion. Unfortunately, this can be a difficult conversation to have, but it's one that we must have to ensure our future human services workforce. And members, I urge you to support this bill, and I would like to turn it over to testifiers at this point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Our first testifier we have is Director Michelle Saint-Cartier. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I don't know if this is all right. Cool. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Saint-Cartier, and as Chair Fisher said, I'm the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with Minnesota Social Service Association. MSSA is an organization of over 4,000 human service professionals from across the state who work in all areas of human services. And I'm here today to urge you to support House File 1494, which would establish a grant to help ensure Health and Human Services provider safety. I have a background in human services, hold a master's in social work and public health, and have worked in direct practice. Now, like many of you, I work in an office. I have assurance that I'll be safe at work. I've never faced any threat to my physical safety, and even faced with some of the very interesting situations we all encounter here at the Capitol, I don't face significant threats to my psychological safety either. This isn't the case for many human service providers. Many don't have the assurance that they'll be safe at work. When they do advocate for their safety, they're sometimes even told that they're exaggerating, bad at their jobs, or even that they're bad people. The reality is, unsafe situations in human services exist and won't go away by ignoring them. We've heard it loud and clear. This is a problem, and it needs to be addressed now. Many MSSA members have bravely shared their experiences with us, including multiple members who were sexually harassed, a member who had a proposed date of death written on a billboard in the middle of town, a member who had major damage done to their vehicle, a member who was threatened with a gun, more than one story of a homicide in a facility where clients lived and providers worked, multiple members who were stalked, and many members who didn't have the training they needed to de-escalate a dangerous situation. Our agencies are desperately trying their best, but they're under-resourced and understaffed. This bill would authorize the Minnesota Department of Human Services to award grants to human service organizations to invest in workplace safety measures. Grants would be used to pay for things like safety training, safety equipment, facility safety improvements, counseling, and systems to track, monitor, and prevent safety incidents. We're proud that MSSA is leading this conversation about workplace safety. The fact of the matter is, when we make the decision to ignore workplace safety for human services, we send a clear message about who we value. We're in the midst of a workforce crisis. As Representative Frederick mentioned, that's projected to get worse. Human service providers will be needed more than ever, and they're not going to tolerate working in positions that don't ensure their safety. We must act on this now. I urge you to pass House File 1494 and show our professionals that we value them. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your testimony and for being here today. Next, I have Mason Schliff. If you'd like to come forward, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mason Schliff, and I am a community human service provider and a Master of Social Work student. I am here today to speak in support of House File 1494, share my experiences with safety incidents in the workplace, and to urge you to make a change to ensure the safety of human service professionals in the workplace like myself. While working with clients in the community, I've experienced multiple safety incidents that have significantly impacted my life. Earlier on in my career, I met with a client before they left for their next appointment. When it came time to transition and leave, the client became escalated, yelling and screaming at me. They then proceeded to kick, punch, and spit on me. I was unable to leave because if I did, my client's safety was at risk. I did not have any support to get myself out of this situation either. I ended up staying with them and enduring the strikes until I was able to contact a peer over the phone who came to help me. After that, I was truly terrified to be around that client, and I had to step away from providing services directly to that client. I think back and I wish that there were safety resources such as safety training that were available to me at that time that I could have used to prevent the situation from escalating. I think if I had these resources, I would have been able to better protect both myself and my client. Instead, it was a terrible experience for both of us. In another position, I worked at a housing complex where an individual was murdered. Safety equipment did not exist in the facility, which meant that, unfortunately, the case has still continued to be unsolved. I spent many hours working in that facility completely alone, which was an expectation for working in my role. It was deeply unsettling to me that this case continues to be unsolved and that the safety of myself, my staff, and my clients would still be at risk. Additionally, after the murder and to this time, I've struggled to process what has truly happened. I had to take unpaid time off to receive therapy and process through the situation and my experience. The lack of safety precautions were entirely normalized at my organization, and I hadn't seen how few resources were available to protect staff and our clients until after this extreme event happened. In my current role, I provide crisis intervention and prevention training. Staff in my training often bring forward concerns about the lack of safety resources available to them, particularly those who serve in rural areas. Being in unsafe situations has been so normalized, and many of my staff don't even realize how unsafe those situations truly are. Having personally experienced being unsafe working in human resources or human services and hearing more experiences from my team, I have been motivated to voice the need for change. I want to do the very best for my clients, and in order to do that, I need to be safe on the job. By passing this bill, you can help ensure workplace safety for current and future human service providers. You can help prevent situations like what I experienced in my work and ensure providers are able to successfully and safely serve their clients. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Schleif, for being here and sharing your experiences with us.
Absolutely.
Next, I have Director Beth Ringer. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Ringer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Social Service Association. I also hold an MSW, and I'm a licensed graduate social worker. In my conversations with MSSA members, it is rare that I meet someone who does not have a personal story about a workplace safety incident. I want to tell a story today of one of MSSA's members, Megan, who was unable to join us in person today. Megan says, "In October 2021, I experienced a physical and sexual assault while on the job. Soon after I started my job, I experienced a situation where I was threatened and yelled at. I did not feel safe going into the home again, but I didn't have the tools or resources to effectively communicate this or keep myself safe. Later, in September 2021, I experienced the joy of getting married. Prior to taking time off for my wedding, I received a case involving a client who needed to meet face-to-face. The events that followed at our first meeting were traumatic and have deeply affected my life. During that meeting, I was physically and sexually assaulted. I'm not going to go into detail about the assault because I want to keep this conversation focused on solution. But at our first meeting, my breasts were grabbed, my crotch was touched, and I was choked. It was a living nightmare and has left me with a great deal of post-traumatic stress. I share the journey of marriage in my life to highlight that I am a human, not just an employee and not just a provider. This event has not only impacted my ability to trust others, but has increased my overall anxiety in day-to-day situations. I care deeply about my clients. I want to do my best work for them, and in order to do that, I need assurance that my safety matters. I need resources in order to keep myself and my clients safe. Megan's story isn't unique. Workplace safety incidents are normalized in human services and are a critical part of the reason that workers are leaving or not going into this field, and this bill offers us an opportunity to begin addressing this issue. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House File 1494? Hearing none, thank you so much. Members, we will now go to members' questions or discussion. Representative Baker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing this. I certainly see, my tours at Cabs Hospital and things like that where things can get very, dangerous for a lot of staff and for the patients that are there too, and I kind of get what you're trying to get to. My question might be, how will we decide who gets the money? And with DHS being part of the receiver of the money and DHS not being receiver of all the money, if I miss the language in here, because I do know that DHS has a good granting and a very robust scoring system, but how will this be handled as to who actually will receive some of the funds? Is there a scoring system? And How does this work?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker. I would say that some of the initial rounds for this grant money, we really wanted to put an emphasis on the greatest need. And the feedback that we had gotten from administering this grant program is, how do you establish what the greatest need is? Because situations can be so different from one to the next. And to place a value judgment that this need is greater than this need, it admittedly could almost be impossible to do. And so the feedback that we had gotten from the department was the preference to do more of a first-come, first-served basis. And so while that may mean not everyone who needs to hopefully benefit from this piece of legislation may not be able to at the end, that is how it is currently established in the amendment, is just as a first-come, first-serve.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, okay. Is it going to be based on, again, first-come, first-serve? I get it. DHS is setting up the program, and they could certainly be first in line. And my concern would be, not that they shouldn't be considered, because they've got some of the folks, they got some of the areas that nobody else wants to touch. And so I know that they should be eligible. Again, in the hotel industry, we have these panic buttons that housekeepers can wear. They get stuck in a room, somebody closes a door, something's going on, they can just push a quick button and it goes off at the front desk, and we immediately have people there. And that costs money to have that done. And I think, I don't know if that kind of thing exists now in most of those settings, where, example, one of your testifiers, you know, had been assaulted. Was there anything like that available to them? But I just want to make sure, with a limited number of one-time dollars, that this somehow doesn't get seen as who got to the pot first, where maybe you're using metrics like, where were the most workplace injuries at? Or is there some kind of metrics that will elevate this to that kind of level, I think is what I'm looking for. Again, I don't think you have all the answers, but I know that it's going to be questions that we need to get right before we pass a bill like this, so that we can go home and talk about this, that we think we try to get it to the right people with the right kind of a metrics that will get it to the right people first.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple different pieces to that. One, on the DE amendment line 1.14, where it talks about eligible applicants include county human service agencies. So it's not the state DHS. While state-level DHS is going to be the one kind of administering the program, they will not be the beneficiary of it. So we're talking county-level human service agencies, tribal human service agencies, and otherwise our private sector human services partners would also be eligible to it. To the point of, if one facility is having multiple incidences, the challenge is if you have one facility that's having 100 incidents, but they're kind of more of a minor incident, where's the priority if you have a different place that is having two, but they're severe? It's a value judgment. Who gets it in that case? You know, or what if they're moderate and somewhere in the middle? Like, how do you rank one from the next? And that is one where we couldn't get an answer to. Like, no one has I don't think a good answer exists. And so if anyone on this committee has feedback for me on that, I'd love to hear it. I don't believe that there is any way to put a true value judgment on a lot of those really hard situations that I think everyone would agree hopefully just doesn't happen.
And thank you, Representative Frederick. And I'll also point out on the DE2 amendment at line 1.1, it does say 40% of the grant funds going, and this goes on to line 1.12, 40% of the grant funds of each fiscal year must be awarded to eligible organizations outside the seven county metro area. So there is some attempt trying to get at how do we make sure that we're getting it across to the different areas of the state that we do need. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, follow up. And I get that, and I thank you, and I saw the 40%. And I think I kind of missed where the county, you know, human service agencies, the tribal human services, and then others, including agencies. So, again, I'm assuming DHS is eligible for these grants, too?
Representative Frederick.
In our conversations, it would not be eligible, since they are going to be the ones who are administering the program. That's been our communications with them.
Representative Baker.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I guess I read that wrong then. So that's where I was kind of going with my questioning is, okay, how do we get that? So I appreciate that. I'm not saying that either they should be ignored, because, again, they have, like in your case, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. Those are some of the most dangerous places, and I want to make sure that our state is providing that protection now for those workers. I think in my case with our CABS hospital, and I think other places which I've had some tours with, I think they do a pretty good job. But again, I don't want them also ignored. So I was actually just considering maybe we should have some county folks involved with this greater good of how we kind of make those decisions. But I think your bill is not going in that direction, is what you're telling me. It just it's worded where I read it as it could be or agencies, which is very broad. So that's all I have, I guess, Mr. Chair. Again, I like what you're doing. It's about worker safety. It's investments that we need to do, and I think this is a little bit outside of our normal operating, you know, reimbursements to counties and so on. We've got to find better ways of making these, again, sometimes older facilities more safe. Cameras are super important, barriers, buzzers, all those things. So again, I like where it's going. I just want to make sure we cook it out right with who's making those decisions. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Any other comments? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. I'm actually going to be signing on or requesting to sign on to this bill. I think that this should have been addressed a long time ago. I've heard horror stories of folks who are just trying to do their job and do it well, and they go in because they have a passion for this. They go in because they want to care for people, and we've thanked them time and again in this committee, and we're not providing support and safety. This should have been addressed a long time ago, but thank you for bringing this forward, and would love to talk after this and see how we can make sure that this happens everywhere.
Thank you, Representative Engen. Representative Frederick, I want to say thank you for bringing the bill forward. You've done a lot of work, I know, on this issue. I appreciate the way the focus has been on trying to figure out what are the services that we can provide, make sure that in terms of trainings, focusing on what we can be doing as providers, what are the systems that can be built out to help provide that safety. And you've been very clear as this is not about penalizing people who might have been in some kind of psychosis or something else that can't control it. So I very much want to say I appreciate the work that you and the advocates have been doing to foster this discussion moving forward. I also know that this is very important. I think that this is something that can also be highly scalable to help get it started and then take a look to keep this going as we move forward. With that, Representative Frederick, any closing comments, and would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. I feel it's important to say it again. I said it once already, but I'm going to say it again. The overwhelming majority of people that are served in some sort of human services capacity are not in any way like threatening or harmful. They're amazing people. But this bill simply seeks to acknowledge that small portion where there is harm happening, and whether it is the barriers or things like that happen. There's also outlined in the bill that we can do training ahead of time to try to prevent like de-escalation training, even so we don't get to that point. But if something bad happens, then you can use this money for counseling services afterwards too. So it tries to take a look at every stage of as we go to try to create a safer experience, and again, the wages, the reimbursement rates, all of that super important too. And so this is just one piece of the bigger puzzle, and so I want to thank MSSA and the absolute countless hours that they have put in working on this bill as well. So thank you for that, and thank you to the committee, and I renew my motion that House File 1494 as amended be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee.
All those in favor of referring House File 1494 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion is approved, and House File 1494 as amended is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. And with that, we have finished our last bill. I'd like to say, first of all, I'd like to thank the seeing we're kind of at the end, we don't have any other bills that will be coming to us at this point in time that I'm aware of. There could be an outside chance that something pops up, and if so, we would make sure we provide plenty of notice. I do want to say thank you to those that have been supporting us. Well, as the representatives here, we do a lot of the voting, et cetera, but the real work gets done by the staff. And so I want to start off by saying thank you to our page that we have in the back. Thank you for being here today. We've got the partisan staff, both on the Democratic and Republican side. Thank you so much for being here. And you're the ones that help make this go along. To the nonpartisan staff who make sure that we can get the language right, thank you for the work. To the folks on my right and left who make sure that I get the proper documents out to the right place and get the right motions in place so that we can make things happen. I want to say a big thank you. Thank you to Lee Keel, Dave Baker, Representative Otney, Backer, Engen. Thank you for being involved. I think we've had a very good discussion over the year here. I know that sometimes we've had some that are more passionate than others, but I appreciate the way that everyone has approached the table to make sure we figure out how do we do things to make things better for our staff. To the DFL side, I want to say the same. Thank you for the hard work on the bills coming forward. We're working collaboratively to help make sure that we're making our state a better place. And I want to say, I know a lot of our bills are heading over to Chair Noor. I hope he will keep our bills in mind as we go forward. Representative Keel, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to thank you and certainly second your thank yous to all the staff, because as we know, nothing ever happens around here without staff. And I appreciate that and the time we've spent, and thank you for working with us on our bills, so with both teams, so thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Keel, and thank you, everyone. With that, there being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.